is are still considered to be quite erotic and alluring. And the toot on the right, you can see the devil himself being conjured up. The other themes for the postcards that I found in this particular book included women in slave markets, women at their toilette, and so on. Many of them were very similar to the kind of pin-up things that you see today. This painting by Correggio is a depiction of Venus and Cupid and a satyr. This particular arrangement and this theme was had a lot of currency in painting. It was just taken on by many artists. It was reproduced many, many times. It became a kind of conventional presentation of Venus. So whenever you saw this, immediately you knew what it was about. Venus's relationship to the satyr is somewhat dubious. Venus's relationship to the Cupid is sometimes somewhat dubious as well. But I found it interesting to compare this to this Pear Soap ad from the late 19th century. It's an American ad, very similar format, the reclining woman, white woman. Cupid now is, of course, elevating the product. And instead of a satyr, a half animal, half human, we have a black woman. One could think that this is simply because of the tradition of slavery. I think there's more to it than that. This is during the period of Reconstruction in the South. And it was a time when a lot of black men were being rounded up and hung as so-called rapists. As Angela Davis has pointed out, the sort of flip side of that, the idea of the black man as rapist, is that black women are animals too. And so I think that there's a double meaning here in that the painting I showed you previously probably would have been quite familiar. It's another way in which certain stories that have been depicted classically, this is Leda and the Swan, well-known rape story, never presented as such though, being picked up in these postcards again. Here we have Leda and the Swan. Once again, looks like she's enjoying herself. And of course, the beauty contest is another scene that translates very well. This is Lucas Cranach's The Judgment of Paris. The winner, of course, was Venus. I think we still have many of those ideas. In fact, we're inundated with pressure to consider always our appearance, our presentability. In Fat and the Fantasy of Perfection, Carol Munter observes, as long as our options are restricted, no woman will experience her body as her home, but rather as her meal ticket. And to the extent that we are unable to develop conviction in our capacity to act, we must rely on the false hope offered to us daily in the power of bodily perfection. Of course, styles change. This is a summary of all the different types of women. This article was by a man, it was by a woman who collected male ideas about women's hairstyles, and we're all there, different flavors of ice cream, all being described according to type. You've got your basic redhead, it's being described in this one. And then, of course, this was followed by a whole article on the changing face of beauty, with different standards, of course, now than we had when Lucas Cranach was painting his painting. Sometimes, of course, advertisers try to appeal to feminist concerns, like professional women. What would a professional woman be concerned about? Power, of course. And here's a positive image of a woman. She's a doctor. However, the product that she's promoting is for menstrual pain. Perhaps she perceives the same problems around menstruation that this woman does. I don't know what she did with the tampon. Uh-huh. These are so ridiculous, but obviously they work. The advertisers wouldn't put them in. She's never waited for a bus in Edmonton in winter, or she'd appreciate her car. But the same attitudes are really quite old. This is a 19th century American advertisement. What the text is basically saying is that these two women are only able to play this game because they got this wonderful tonic that they purchased, which did away with all their bad humor because of the female condition. Yeah. I won't read it all. Yeah. I thought I'd bring in something from another culture. A friend of mine recently went to Hungary and procured this rare book. There's not a lot of girly magazines, pornography, whichever you want to call it, available in Hungary. But once a year, they do have this publication. It's a soccer annual, and it's a sports magazine, and it talks about this, about soccer. And so that's what that this is about. It's a soccer magazine, and men line up at all of the distribution centers for hours to get this. And it, this is just the cover. We see the insides coming. I've only got a couple of slides of the inside. What I found interesting was how they seem to see this kind of image. This is their idea of pinups, I guess. This kind of art image to be continuous with the local talent. They also had photographs from Playboy and Penthouse magazine. I guess they had bought the rights to reproduce these. But I thought I would show you what sort of the local flavor to things. Sometimes there are attempts to intervene or to reveal these traditions. This particular photograph shows us clearly the kind of relationship of fruit to woman's body. There's already been a few slides that I've shown that have dealt with that. One could say, fine, fruit is exotic, erotic, and so on, but somehow it doesn't work when you try to reverse it. This is woman as viewer, I guess. Both of these pictures were taken by Linda Nochlin, and it's part of an article she wrote on woman as sex object. Again, I have a photograph by a woman, Alice Springs, supposedly about how women can be fixated at looking at other women. Marcia Resnick takes the same theme and makes it humorous by adding her own text. Without at the same time, anyway, taking away from what those implications are. For those who can't read, it says she was horrified to know that she had been walking around school all day with her skirt hiked up on the back. She does some other ones like this that have to do with menstruation. And okay, well, I'm just about finished then. This is it. I just wanted to finish with a couple of comments about Willem de Kooning that Walter Cuspet made in a recent article that was in Vanguard magazine. And this particular painting is from about 1949. It's called Woman. The figure in Rosenberg's terms, Cuspet is referring to Rosenberg's criticism of de Kooning, is even conceivable as an afterthought, a dubious afterimage loosely associated with the ejaculatory paint. But can't we then go one step further and say that the female figure is the dream image that evoked the discharge and appears in the picture provocatively veiled by it? For if woman's image makes little sense apart from the discharge of paint, then she exists only in terms of the warped vision whose agent is the energized paint. So I think I'll stop there and sort of leave it up to the discussion to get your own kind of reactions to this. guess this will have to do.
Okay, I'm just going to try and take this. Can you turn that light switch on the post there?
Pardon?
Is that okay?
Well, it does make a hum. Anyway, we'll just go ahead with this. What I wanted to, I'm going to just give you a little outline of what I'm going to talk about and then just go full steam ahead. I'm supposed to talk on the subject of sex as a commodity, and I could probably talk for about 3 days on that, so I'm trying to keep it down to a few ideas to just toss out at you to think about. I first of all wanted to talk a little about the social context in which we're dealing with imagery at this present time in history. And that's not going to cover everything, but at least it'll touch on a few ideas. Then I want to deal a little bit with some of the progressive and feminist responses and debates about that imagery. A little bit about the consumption of sexual imagery and what the sex industry is appealing to, how it's constrained by its own dictates. And then I want to talk a little bit about what we can do. So the sale of sex and the representation of sex are among the most hotly contested issues in the social and political arena these days. Why? Well, sex has always been a hot topic, but today there's also more media involvement in the issue, more media attention, more technology, more distribution, and more media investment in the issue of censorship and free speech. So the debate has grown to correspondingly large proportions. But mainly I think sex is a hot topic because it's come to represent the major ground of conflict and contest between old values and new. It's where entire belief systems clash and jostle for an edge, playing out their bid for power in the sexual arena. In the past 30 years, we've been witnessing, and probably most of us participating in, a loosening of the social constraints on sexual behavior. Certain traditional sexual values have been challenged and probably irrevocably changed from the way they were. Sex outside of marriage is no longer viewed with the universal disdain it once was. People talk about and practice birth control. Sexual variation is more widely acknowledged and accepted, and so on. These relatively new phenomena have been labeled under the term the sexual revolution. And while many of them may not be particularly revolutionary, they do represent an advance from the secretive, repressive, and restrictive regime that once smothered and controlled sexuality in the past. Alongside the sexual revolution, there have been other simultaneous changes occurring, most significantly the change in women's role in the last two decades. Women have entered the workforce in unprecedented numbers and achieved unprecedented degrees of economic independence, though certainly not wealth. As a result, the traditional male-dominated family has been shaken to its roots. Women have chosen other options. More and more are living alone, living as single parents, in other variations of the traditional family, or in alternatives they've tried to create to that family. The needs that both women and men brought to the family are now met increasingly outside of that traditional structure, or not at all. And what we are seeing more and more is that rather than trying to meet needs in one close, all-encompassing group or environment, women and men fragment these needs into separate components and go to different people and places to satisfy them, to social services, informal community gathering places, community organizations and institutions, and to the commercial marketplace. During the same period, we've been dealing with an increasingly overloaded marketplace, a marketplace that aggressively seeks out our attention, our disposable income, our loyalty to corporate names. It's ushered in the consumer age, where buying is now consumer science and getting a good deal is consumer rights. The advertising, come on, entices us from all sides, and we're constantly assured that no matter what our needs or desires may be, there is a product to satisfy them. And we've been well trained to respond to this message. We can be lured by the soothing idea that if we're bored, frustrated, lonely, angry, or whatever, or even just looking for fun and excitement, we need to look no further than the Eaton's catalog, the local drug mart,
or the entertainment world for the object, the substance, or the experience that will alleviate our need. And it's against the background of these changing conditions that we have seen the development of an industry specializing in the representation of sex, an industry that's gained a wider distribution for its products than similar materials have done at any other time in history. But I want to go back to the family for a moment, because I think the historical changes going on there have had a profoundly important relationship to sexual changes. 30 years ago, girls knew that sex was something you saved for marriage. Whether or not they did may have been determined by many of the material and emotional conditions they faced at the time, but they knew if they didn't wait, they lowered their value in the marriage market. What I'm getting at here is that within the traditional moralist view of sexuality, women's sexuality has been a commodity. It was one of the things a man got in return for supporting the woman who promised to give it only to him. Both the women and the men knew the market value of sex as a commodity. And this worked as long as women were not seen to be receiving anything in the act of sex itself. We were giving something that was not supposed to have any inherent value to us except as a bartering tool. We would be considered fools to give it away for nothing. But what happens when women reclaim sexuality? As women are now trying to some degree coming into our own power as sexual beings. In this post-feminist era, we're all supposedly equal partners in sexual acts with our right to pleasure, our right to make demands. It seems we are to be sexually assertive, confident, powerful, guilt and shame-free, and multiply orgasmic. And yet, we somehow still have the feeling that maybe we're losing ground, that maybe we're losing out somewhere. We're plagued by the old paradigm of the virgin and the whore, the split sexual identity offered to women throughout history. Where we find ourselves is caught between two equally prescriptive and male-defined value systems about women's sexuality. The traditional one, where we are one man's possession or worthless, and the commercially liberated one, where the Playboy philosophy makes us every man's possession and tells us that sexual consumption is the road to liberation. In between, we founder to create our own definitions and resistance, while these two value systems continue to bump into each other, masquerade as each other, and try to subvert each other. When we do take our sexual power into our own hands, we do not necessarily change how we are seen by either of these prescriptive models, and our liberation is elusive. In the progressive movements, there have been a variety of different views and debates on the subject of sexuality, as Sarah outlined. I'm only going to be able to touch on a couple of those. I'm sure other people will bring them up too. I want to elaborate on one of those debates because it reflects the definitions of women's sexuality I've been talking about. Early feminist discussion of sexuality centered firstly on regaining our right to sexuality at all. When it grew clear that reclaiming our sexuality didn't mean that we overcame sexism, feminists moved quickly into a discussion of gender relations and the power imbalance between women and men. We looked at prescriptions about body image, body type, and age. We looked at the objectification of women in the media and at the roles of the fashion and cosmetics industry. We raised the issue of heterosexism and the oppression of lesbians. And finally, we looked at how male violence towards women, and sexual violence specifically, served to entrench the sexist hierarchy. But what feminism has concentrated on are the ways that women's sexuality has been prescribed and damaged by men, and how male power has made women not just commodities, but victims in a system stacked against us. Because feminism has concentrated on describing victimization of women, feminist language is about victims. In a sense, feminism continues to define women as commodities. It tries to tell the real story of what it's like to live that way. The language and imagery envisioning us out of that role into something else is underdeveloped. The sexual liberationist view, or the sex radicals view, focuses on women as active sexual agents. that analysis points to ways that sexuality per se is stifled and controlled in this culture by those conservative forces that would control sexual expression and restrict variation from the dominant heterosexual monogamous norm. Sex radicals describe a sexual hierarchy which values and validates certain kinds of sexual behavior while outlawing others, whose practitioners are seen as fair game for discrimination and abuse. Transvestites, transsexuals, sadomasochists, people who sell sex, people who engage in cross-generational sex. Homosexuality and lesbianism are in what might be called the contested zone. But even there, the hierarchy operates to value those who are in monogamous relationships more highly than those who have multiple partners. This analysis frames sexuality as a civil rights question, affirming the rights of sex radicals to explore variation without being discriminated against, either by mainstream culture or by progressive movements. The vision of this movement is towards a society in which people could freely engage in whatever sexual practice they chose with other consenting people. The vision of feminists has tended to pose a picture of sexual relations between equal partners where dominance and submission do not come into play. Now, I think both of these analyses have something important to say about how women's sexuality is shaped and prescribed in our culture. But they both fall short of being able to encompass the present situation and reflect women's position in it. Sex radicals appear to have minimized the pervasiveness of sexism and how sexuality is used to reinforce male power, specifically through violence and sexual dominance. They have failed to grapple with the commodification of sex itself, and in particular the commodification of women, and have downplayed the role played by the media in that process. Feminists, on the other hand, have failed to grasp the power of sexual moralism and repression as it extends beyond gender divisions and the specific oppression of lesbians. And they've oversimplified the role of power in sexuality. There's only begun to develop in either camp any discussion of class or race in the formation of individual sexuality or in sexual politics. Only the beginnings of a dialogue have occurred about fantasy and desire and their relationship to our sexual or political realities. Let us say that at the very least, we have so far developed only a rudimentary framework with which to view sexuality and have only the barest of tools with which to arrive at a theory about sexual representation. Having said all that, I'm going to try and talk about sexual representation. What are the needs people express in seeking out sexual imagery? Obviously, they're varied. A basic need for sexual information is certainly central, and one that is difficult to satisfy out of the commercial marketplace. For some, there is a desire for sexual stimulation, for sensuality, and for material that validates and appreciates sexuality, that absolves us of guilt or shame for sexual feelings, and that heightens pleasure and enjoyment. There may be the desire for actual sexual contact. There may be alienation, loneliness, feelings of powerlessness, frustration, boredom, or whatever. There may be the expectation that representations will provide sexual fulfillment, or sexual reassurance, or the experience of power, or confirmation of faltering beliefs or attitudes, or simple distraction. Whatever the needs, I would suggest that they are complex and varied, and probably also differ widely between women and men. So let's take a look at the sex industry that responds to these market demands. What needs is the industry itself constrained by? And I'll suggest that paramount among them is the need to make money. This calls for, as we all know, the least amount of financial layout for the greatest amount of return. So it affects things like the wages workers are paid in the industry and working conditions for those workers. The degree of sexual repression, sexism, and racism in society will also influence how low those wages can be kept without being challenged. The profit motive will also determine, to some extent, the production quality of materials produced. But this is also influenced by consumer expectations, by art conventions, and by community, I hate to use the term community standards. What I want to talk more about, though, are the sexual values that the industry reflects and promotes in order to ensure its continued place in the capitalist marketplace. A predominant value assumption of most of the imagery that surrounds us is that sex is something to be bought, sold, and consumed, primarily by men, and that this kind of activity in the marketplace has something to do with our liberation. This is a fairly essential concept if sex is to be successful as a money-making commodity. At the same time, while there has been a specialized market developing for the gay population, most commercial representations concentrate on heterosexuality from a dominant and often misogynist male perspective. In this sense, they perpetuate the notion of the male as consumer of sex and the female as consumed, the commodity. By omission, they distance the possibility of sexual relations between people that go beyond objectification. So the industry has selected a particular market to appeal to, the male, predominantly heterosexual, but also gay, white population, that very population that has the most disposable income and the most interest in maintaining male dominance. But there is an ongoing interrelationship in much of commercial imagery between the traditional moral view of sexuality and the so-called liberated view. The image makers do appeal to conflicting values and confusions about sex, to guilt and shame, as well as to aggression and machismo. They use symbols, scenarios, and language that evoke traditional moralistic concepts of vice and virtue, while permitting the viewer to transgress certain sexual taboos, both by the act of viewing itself and by the transgressions of actors within the material. But lest anyone out there would claim that this breaking down of sexual taboos is a progressive step towards our liberation as women, I would suggest they would do well to look at what taboos and sexual conventions are not broken in commercial sex and imagery. For example, the image of women as sexually insatiable and ever available, the over-sexualized images of women of color, the class stereotypes of both women and men. So while a lot of imagery may appeal to repress sexuality, to forbidden fantasies and thoughts, not a lot of it addresses them in a progressive or conscious way. It reinforces those attitudes that have limited and impinged on women's sexuality for centuries, and simply markets them as liberation. So what can we do as activists and artists who are working to change sexual relations and representations to resonate with real women's lives and desires? We live in a historical moment that offers a whole new possibility for exploration. The limited definitions of morally correct sex and liberated sex have been opened up by the gay liberation movement, by the discussion of sexual violence against women, and by the debate over pornography and censorship. They've been difficult discussions, but valuable in forcing many of us to think beyond the bounds of our usual frameworks. There's an amazing potential at this moment, I think, to carry on a dialogue about sexuality that was not earlier possible. We run the risk of going in either of two extreme directions, attempting to stifle sexual representation and thereby our own potential freedom to engage in further exploration, or opting in favor of some false god of sexual consumerism with the idea that this amounts to freedom. If we want change, we're going to have to challenge existing sexual relations as well as produce our own material about sex. We need to be talking about and portraying what sexuality really is for us, rather than what industry-defined representations or traditional morality tell us. Where do we place ourselves when we view images? Where does our own experience coincide with representations? Where does it not? What are the different levels of feelings that move us to sexual action or not? When does sexual behavior involve escape? When does it involve terrifying honesty and confrontation with ourselves? When does it involve fear and danger? What is the nature of pleasure, and how can we represent it? How do we experience the power of sex? How do we avoid it? How do we envision it? What are the elements that trigger desire? How do the conditions of our daily lives affect our sexuality? How does our personal history affect it? How can we portray these kinds of concerns in our art, in our work for social change? As producers of imagery, I think we need to consciously address the conventions of mass media, examine the signs and symbols that have acquired a sexual meaning, examine the sources of those meanings, invent and redesign our own. We can look, for starters, at the sexist stereotyping of women and men and create those that allow a wider range of behavior, of body types, of ages, of cultural and racial contexts. We can challenge and change the role of viewer as invisible voyeur. We can look at racist assumptions and their role in sexual dynamics. We can challenge the sexual imperative itself, the pressure from the sexual marketplace to be a sexual consumer. In some cases, we may be able to use the conventions of mass media creatively to expose some of its assumptions. Let's hope we can also create original images that resonate with our own experience, our desire, images that are for women and that prompt us to examine and enjoy our sexuality in a conscious way. We're still faced, nevertheless, with a mass industry involving millions of dollars. And as independent artists and producers, we can't really compete with this market. We can produce alternative materials that enter an alternate marketplace. We can try to work in the mass media with new images, despite the limited success women have in this area. We can try to organize our own alternate networks, a women's TV station, radio station, or whatever. But in the face of the pornography industry, I think it is also our responsibility to make our critical voices heard, to continue to confront those image makers and image brokers who present a warped and hideous picture of women. We cannot expect our governments to do this on our behalf, and we've seen in the last few years just how capable they are of doing it.